feet and daylight unto my path. And a light unto, a light unto my path, my path.
Welcome to Searchlight, a survey through Scripture with Pastor John Corson. It is our desire to bring you a systematic study of the entire Bible, chapter by chapter, book by book. Today on Searchlight, we are beginning a study through the book of 2 Samuel. This book is really a continuation of 1 Samuel. In that book, we saw Israel transitioning from being ruled by judges to being ruled by Saul, their first king. But Saul turned his back on the Lord, and eventually God chose another king, David. But David has not been crowned as king yet, and we saw that most of the time David has been running from Saul, who was trying to kill him. The primary focus of 2 Samuel will be on David as he becomes king of Israel. But as we begin our study today, we still have some unfinished business with King Saul. With the story from 2 Samuel chapter 1, here now is Pastor John.
Tonight we're starting 2 Samuel, so if you would turn there at this time, 2 Samuel chapter 1. In 1983, the question was that was burning and stirring and raging across the country, who shot J.R.? Now, if you're old enough to remember that, you're dating yourself just a bit. But that was the question, who shot J.R.? And people went through the summer wondering, speculating, until the fall season opened up, and the answer was then given. In 1993, 10 years later, the question was, who really assassinated JFK? Oliver Stone, of course, came out with his movie and renewed that controversy once more. Was there a conspiracy that assassinated President John F. Kennedy? Well, in our story tonight, at this time, the question is, who really killed Saul? And it's a bit mysterious, and it's somewhat speculative. Because, you see, in our story last time, last Sunday, if you were here, we saw Saul committing suicide on Mount Gilboa. As the Israelites were fighting the Philistines, Saul's soldiers were falling like flies before his very eyes. And then Saul's sons died right next to him. And finally, an arrow from a Philistine soldier pierced Saul's body. And the life of Saul was draining from him when he said to his armor bearer, "Kill me. Put me out of this misery. Don't let the Philistines abuse me, kill me." The armor bearer would not do that. And so Saul, we are told, fell on his own sword. And he died on Mount Gilboa. But what really happened? Is it true that he committed suicide, as we read in our previous study in chapter 31 of 1 Samuel? Or is it a little more complicated than that? Well, in chapter 1, we see that there is some complicating factors in the story. Let's get into it and take a look. Now it came to pass after the death of Saul, the first king of Israel, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had abode 2 days in Ziklag, that is the city that David and his men were inhabiting, the city that was given to him by Achish, the Philistine king. David was residing there. David had run away from Judah, from Israel. And he was now hanging with the Philistines because he was afraid that Saul was going to get him. And we talked about that at great length, and you probably remember the story. He was in a place he ought not to be. And yet his heart was still inclined towards the Lord, still tender and hungry for the Lord. Well, he's there in that town of Ziklag. Well, it came to pass on the third day, a man came out of the camp from Saul with his clothes rent or shredded, and there was earth or dust upon his head. And so it was when he came to David that he fell to the earth and did obeisance. With shredded clothes and dusty head, he falls to the ground and bows to David. And David said, "From whence comest thou?" And he said, "Out of the camp of Israel am I escaped." David said, "How went the matter? How went the battle?" David, of course, wasn't there engaged in that battle. He was at Ziklag while the battle was underway. So David was anxious to hear what happened that day. "How went the matter? I pray thee, tell me." So the man answered, "The people are fled from the battle, and many of the people also are fallen and dead. And Saul, King Saul, and Jonathan, his son, are dead also." David said to the young man that told him, "How knowest thou that Saul and Jonathan, his son, be dead? How do you know this is so?" And the young man that told him said, "As I happened by chance upon Mount Gilboa, the place where the battle was being fought, behold, Saul leaned upon his spear, or fell on his spear, and lo, the chariots and the horsemen of the Philistines followed hard after him. They were coming in his direction. And when he looked behind him, he saw me, and he called unto me. And I answered and said, 'Here am I.' And Saul said to me, 'Who are you?' And he answered, I answered him saying, 'I am an Amalekite.' And Saul said to me again, 'Stand, I pray thee, upon me and slay me. Stand upon me and lop off my head. For anguish has come upon me because my life is yet in me.'" In other words, I'm not dead. So it would seem as though Saul had attempted suicide, but didn't do the job successfully. And now he's there on the ground in agony. He sees this young man looming over him, standing over him. "Finish me off, please," he says. "Do me in." So the young man says, verse 10, "I stood upon him and I slew him because I was sure that he could not live after that he was fallen. He fell on his spear or on his sword. He couldn't survive that. So I took the crown that was upon his head and the bracelet that was on his arm and have brought them here to you, my Lord." This Amalekite or Amalekite had in his hand the crown that Saul wore and the bracelet that was on his wrist. And I'm sure he was as proud, as pleased as punch. Because after all, he would know that Saul was one who had been chasing David like a partridge, and he no doubt would assume that David would be delighted to hear that Saul was no longer on the scene, that he was dead. And no doubt this guy thought, "I'm going to be rewarded by David. After all, I took care of his enemy. I took care of the guy that was after him constantly. Certainly he's going to be pleased with me. Certainly he's going to give a reward to me. No doubt about it." I can recall the same kind of feeling. I was as pleased as punch. I was proud as a peacock when I surfaced there at Lover's Point, where I was skin diving there at Pacific Grove, at Lover's Point, coming up with a great big rock cod on the end of my spear. I was 15 years of age at the time, just getting into skin diving and spear fishing and all of the rest. And it was the first time I took my gun out, my spear gun, and I was delighted and thrilled when I surfaced. My mom and dad were on the beach. I waved the fish, "Look at this, look at this." And my dad, mom on the beach some distance away looked, and then I saw them motioning to me. I thought they were waving, so I waved back. They were telling me to go back under, in reality. I soon found out why, because you see, behind them, I didn't see it at the time, was a police car. And the police car then turned his lights on and got on the loudspeaker and said, "Would the young man, the skin diver with the fish, come in immediately?" So I made my way in. I thought, oh, man, the cop wants to see the big game killer that I am. He wants to see the fish that I speared. This is great. This is grand. When I got in, I realized that wasn't the case. He looked at me and he said, do you realize, son, that you are spearfishing in an underwater game reserve? No wonder the fish were so easy to get. They were all over the place, on every side of me. It was wonderful. I found out, though, that, hey, I ought not to be doing that in there. My parents, when they heard that, they walked away. And, Mom, Dad, wait, come back here. Who are you? As they went their way down the beach. Not really. They stood there with me, and we talked to the cop, and the cop, well, he could have fined me $500 or put me in jail, but he didn't. I was let go. I was allowed to once again enter into the water, but this time without my spear gun. But, you know, it's so often we find ourselves, hey, look what I got. Check this out. And in reality, it's a fish from a game reserve. And that's this man's story. Look what I have. I have a crown here and a bracelet. It's from Saul. You know, he was there on the ground, and I finished him off. And David, I've brought this to you. Well, then David, in hearing that, hey, he wasn't responding the way this guy no doubt thought he would. This guy thought he would be rewarded or elevated or honored or something, but we'll see that's not what happened. David took hold on his own clothes, and he rent them. He ripped them up. And likewise, all the men that were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening time for Saul and for Jonathan, his son, and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. Verse 13, then David said to this young guy, who was the one who claimed to kill Saul, the Amalekite, he said, whence art thou? Where are you from? And he said, I am the son of a stranger. I'm not one of Israel. I'm a foreigner. I am an Amalekite. And David said, verse 14, how wast thou not afraid to stretch forth thy hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? Who do you think you are? How dare you stretch forth your hand and take the life of one that's anointed by the Lord? Even though Saul, as we have seen, was a despicable character, even though he was being manipulated by the devil, even though he hardened his heart against the Lord, yet David recognized that Saul was in a position that the Lord allowed Saul to be in. And David, when he had opportunity himself to kill Saul on two occasions, didn't do so, but said, how could it be that I would dare touch the anointed of the Lord? And the lesson there for you, the lesson for me, obviously, is this. Even people that we might think are despicable or instruments of the enemy, in reality, they're in that position for a reason. God has allowed them to be in that place. The position they're in must be respected by you and respected by me, because God has allowed them to be in that place. Why? To work on us, perhaps. To make us better than we otherwise would be. To teach us how to love, or how to be patient, or how to trust, or how to turn the other cheek, or whatever. We're not to take things into our own hands and try and solve the problem. And David didn't do that when he had a chance, as we saw, to lop off Saul's head twice. He said, I'm not going to touch the Lord's anointed. So now David turns to this guy. How dare you? How dare you touch the Lord's anointed? You should have been afraid to stretch forth your hand against that man, because God put him in that place. And David called for one of his young men, verse 15, and said, go and fall upon him. Take him out. And so the young man did that. He smote that Amalekite, and the Amalekite died. Not exactly the prize I think that he thought he was going to get. Instead, he is killed. David says, put him to death. Take him out. How could it be that he would have the audacity to touch the Lord's anointed and take the crown and hold the bracelet, think that he would get credit? Take him out. Finish him off. And so that was done. And David said unto him, Thy blood be upon thy head, for thy mouth has testified against thee, saying, I have slain the Lord's anointed. I'm not responsible for your death, David is saying here. You're responsible for the loss of your life because your own mouth confessed. Your own words were spoken, admitting, glorying in perhaps that you had done this despicable deed that ought not to have been done, you see. Now, the question is, so what happened here? Chapter 31 of 1 Samuel says that Saul fell upon his sword and he died. The armor bearer, verse 5 of chapter 31 of 1 Samuel, saw Saul die, and when he saw that Saul was dead, then he, the armor bearer, took his life too. This guy's story is a bit different than that. This guy says, no, when I came to Mount Gilboa, Saul was wounded. He tried to kill himself, but didn't do so successfully, so I finished him off. The question is, so what really happened? Chapter 31 seems to imply that Saul fell on his sword and his armor bearer watched him die. Chapter 1 here of 2 Samuel says, though, an Amalekite came on the scene and finished off the job. So what's going on? Two possibilities. Number one, the Amalekite is lying here. He looks at this as a way to get ahead, as a way to be exalted, as a way to receive position or recognition. And he was there, he sees Saul is dead, so he says, hey, this is my opportunity, my big break. I'm going to take the crown off the dead body of Saul and the bracelet too, and I'm going to tell David, the guy that Saul was always chasing, I'm the guy that finished off your enemy. That's a possibility. Or it could be, secondly, that exactly what happened here is what happened. And that is, the armor bearer who watched Saul fall and die thought that Saul was dead, but Saul kind of struggled and was coming back again. The armor bearer was now dead next to him. And then Saul, struggling, gasping, now wakes up, if you would, and sees this guy, and this guy does what he said. Which one was it? Don't know. Could be either one. We can speculate endlessly. Can't say for sure. But this we do know. An Amalekite was on the scene. An Amalekite. Interesting. Because you might recall that over 25 years earlier, God said to Saul, I want you to kill every single Amalekite. The Amalekites, you see, were constantly, perpetually paining the people of Israel. Ever since the people of Israel left Egypt and made their way to the promised land, being led by Moses, the Amalekites were those that would attack the back of the pack, where the older folks were walking, or mothers with their brand new babies, or those that were sick or weak or feeble. The Amalekites would attack the back and pick them off and showed no mercy. And God declared in Exodus chapter 17 to Moses, you are to go to war against the Amalekites. And from generation to generation to generation, you shall war against them. Indeed, generations went by. Moses indeed did launch an attack against the Amalekites in Moses' day by sending Joshua. Do you recall the story there at Rephidim? Joshua, take the soldiers and go fight the Amalekites. I'm going to go to the mountain. I'm going to pray. And he held up his hands. You recall the story? And when his hands were held high, Joshua and the Israelites were gaining victory. But when his hands began to sag, the Amalekites came back. Finally, Aaron on one side and Hur on the other held up Moses' hands until Joshua in the valley below secured the victory that day against those Amalekites. And God then said to Moses, write this down and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, that he might know that the key to victory over Amalek, the Amalekites, wasn't military strategy or bravery, but rather it was prayer. It was prayer on the mountain. It was prayer on this hill going up for him that made the difference in the valley down below. And as we've talked about, that is the first part of the Bible ever written. Before the law was given, before the Torah was penned, even before Job was written. The first part of the Bible ever penned was that Exodus 17 story where God declared, "Write this, Moses, and tell it to Joshua." The key to his victory over the Amalekites wasn't his ability or ingenuity, but it was intercessory prayer, you see. Prayer is the key. Now, the Amalekites, in Bible typology, they're a picture of, a type of, an illustration of the flesh. That's why God says you're going to fight them from generation to generation. The Amalekites speak of and are an illustration of the flesh. We don't have time to go into the full story tonight, but you look at why they came into being or how they came into being, and it speaks of, from the very get-go, fleshly, sensual activity. So these Amalekites are a symbol, a picture of the flesh. And God says, you're to fight against them. And then God spoke through the prophet Samuel in our story here to Saul, destroy him, destroy him, destroy him, destroy him. Every man, every woman, every child, all the sheep, all the cattle, everything they own, everything they have is to be utterly, completely destroyed. Saul said, okay. And he takes the Israelite army out to battle. And then after the battle, he makes his way back towards where Samuel the prophet was. And Saul says, oh, blessed be the Lord. We have obeyed what the Lord has sent us to do. We have been victorious over the Amalekites. Samuel the prophet said, well, tell me, if that's so, if you destroyed all the sheep and all the cattle, what's this bleeding, this baaing I hear in my ear? Oh, well, we saved a few of the sheep to bring and sacrifice to the Lord. And Samuel, with a frown on his face, said, really? The word was that you were to destroy them and take no prisoners, take nothing from them, and you brought these sheep here? And who's that? Who's that in chains right there? Oh, Saul said, well, that's Agag. He's the king of the Amalekites. I brought him back here as a trophy. What do you think? Samuel said, because you have not obeyed the Lord, the kingdom has been taken from you. You have lost your authority. You've lost your opportunity. You've lost your ministry. Why? Because you are supposed to kill every Amalekite and not mess with the sheep or the cattle or the stuff that they have. But because you didn't do that, because you played around, Saul, you brought some sheep back and you thought you had this Amalekite all boxed up and in control. Man, you're in trouble, Saul. The irony is this. Now, at the end of his life, who finally does him in? Very likely, it was an Amalekite.
Interesting. Saul is done in by an Amalekite, the very people that God told Saul to destroy. This is the problem with disobedience to God. It will come back to haunt us. Pastor John will continue discussing this on our next program and will make an important application for us. Please join us again then.
This teaching is also available on the Searchlight website at johncorson.com. You will also find on the website Pastor John's books and other Bible study resources. Again, the address of the website is johncorson.com.
We are all on a journey in this life. And if you are a believer in God, your journey is taking you to heaven. To help us keep our eyes on our destination, we have a book available called A Place for You, Reflections on Heaven. This book, taken from sermons that John has given, focuses on the hope of heaven. Heaven is a real place, and it is not that far away. This book is for everyone who longs for that day when we will be in heaven with our Savior. You may order a place for you from our website at johncorson.com.
Searchlight is a listener-supported ministry. We appreciate your prayers and support. May the Lord richly bless you.